You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
It's all cold down along the beach. The wind's whipping down the boardwalk. Hey, man! You guys know what time of year it is? What time, huh? You guys all been good and practicing real hard. Yeah. Clients, you've been rehearsing real hard now. So stand and bring your new saxophone, right? Everybody out there been good or what? Oh, that's not many. You guys in trouble out here. And you better watch out. You better not cry. You better not bow. I'm telling you why. Santa Claus is coming to town. Santa Claus is coming to town. Santa Claus is coming to town. He's making a list, he's checking it.
My thanks to Gunnery Sergeant Wayne Bowie for coming on. Pretty interesting questions he asked. Yeah, why don't they go to school? Now, the gunner said, well, because they're not staff. You know, infantry officers and officers in general are staff that... But I think more and more gets asked of our staff NCOs, but we haven't expanded the educational opportunities. So I need to get the commandant back out and ask him about that. I have yet to see Springsteen on Broadway. I will watch that. I did watch Santa Claus 1, 2, and I made it halfway through 3 before I fell asleep. So I'll report back on that one. Not on Santa Claus 3, but on Springsteen. I wanted to share a tweet with you and then an article with you. Gunner's no bueno today. He's got some physical issues that he's dealing with. So let me share with you the tweet. Okay. Here's a tweet by a woman by the name of Wendy Addison. Speak out, speak up. Wendy Addison is a whistleblower, speaker, advocate, and trainer for Courageous Conversations, skydiver, adventurer of life, tiny house leader. Not sure what all that means. Anyway, but she either retweeted or is, I saw somebody else retweeted this. It had her name on it. Every society has to realize that children and adults too need adversity to grow strong, Haight said. We can't reach maturity without adversity. Jonathan Haight is a social psychologist at NYU Stern, author of The Righteous Mind, Reflections on How Social and Moral Psychology Can Improve Companies, Universities, and Societies. Oh, so adversity, I shouldn't send you home or send you to therapy? I shouldn't cancel classes. I shouldn't do that. I should make you fight through it the way we used to. Can you see our society coming full circle and saying, oh, there was a reason that the way they got raised contributed to their success. Oh, there was a reason that they didn't become dysfunctional. Oh, I get it. There was actually a cause and effect. And all that stuff we thought was really calloused and insensitive really was there to teach us that our feelings weren't supposed to be at the center of our very existence. That if you live your life based on your feelings, you're doomed. It won't turn out well. It won't turn out well. And so it's just interesting, right? And let me tell you, Why are athletics so good for young people? Because you fail. And then you succeed. And normally, if you succeed, it's because you went back in there and did the work. And if you failed and you've done your best, you can live with that. And so again, there's just all those great lessons. But we have become, you know, again, there's another word beyond helicopter parents, you know. I mean, so you, all the adversity in front of your kid, you don't let them deal with. You don't let them fight through. You don't encourage that fight. Hey, you can do it. I believe in you. I know you can do it. Don't quit. Put your head down. Keep going. All that shit we got taught. And now we're coming full circle to, yeah, this whole feelings-based existence is not really what I'm looking for. Okay, so I say that about adversity, which leads me to something I read. Which leads me to something I read over the weekend. The headline caught my eye. The headline of the article is called Depths of Despair. What can be done about America's declining life expectancy? On November 29th, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention released three reports on disturbing topics that no one quite knows how to address. One of them, their annual review, Mortality in America, reveals that in 2017, American life expectancy dropped for the third straight year, not since 1918, when a flu pandemic was piled atop of the miseries of war, has that happened. Think about that. No pandemic, no war. The causes of today's decline are far less dramatic. CDC Director Robert Redfield announced that this troubling trend is largely driven by deaths from drug overdoses and suicide. How about that? So now, 3 years in a row, never happened in the history of the country. Suicide and drug overdoses. What's causing this? Is it linked to our inability to deal with adversity in life? Where does that come from? Data from the CDC shows that these three interrelated trends have moved slowly but steadily in one direction. Such consistent decline is unprecedented. Back in 1918, life expectancy plummeted a full 15 years thanks to the Spanish flu, only to bounce back to an all-time high the following year. What we would have today is a more gradual slide, or what we have today is a more gradual slide. The suicide rate has likewise been worse before, spiking drastically during the Great Depression, but never has it risen so steadily for so long. Over the last 18 years, the rate of suicide has grown by 33% from an all-time low in 1999 to a rate as high as any since the 1930s. Remember, 1930s is depression. Over the past decade, deaths from drug overdoses rose by a steady 3% per year until 2015, when the rate accelerated to an alarming 16% per year. In 2017, 22 of every 100,000 Americans died by overdose and 14 by suicide. Now, I don't know what that means. So compared to, and the article seeks to put this in context. All right. Article goes on. Plenty of data is available, but we still don't know very much about the deeper issues underlying these deaths of despair. As Princeton professors Ann Case and Angus Deaton have dubbed them, while the CDC and other federal agencies publish data on life expectancy and related trends, they tend to avoid broad explanations for what they report. Redfield's brief statement called for action but offered no answer. Of course, academics and commentators are always eager to propose explanations. Researchers outside the public sector tend to look at deaths of despair as economic and medical problems, requiring economic and medical solutions. At an event at Harvard University's Center for Population and Development Studies, Deaton and University College of London's Michael Marmo identified income inequality as, quote, the key to global health in general and to deaths of despair in particular, which means we should all go to a communist system and everybody will be happy. Except that's not the way it works. Meanwhile, in the New York Times, Moises Velasquez-Manoff proposed that we fight suicide with better drugs, arguing that because no new classes of drugs has been developed to treat depression, and by extension, suicidality in the last 30 years, the United States should liberalize the use of ketamine as an alternative to conventional antidepressants. But the limits of these approaches become more obvious the more we learn about deaths of despair. On one hand, it's difficult to believe deaths of despair are simple markers of economic anxiety. The CDC's new report on suicide shows the rate grew at the same pace before the 2008 recession as it did during and after it, while it's rising fast among people old enough to have lost a job to automation. It's rising just as fast among people too young to have ever held jobs. Overdose deaths are hardly exclusive to the strained circumstances of blue-collar and red-state America. They happen relatively frequently in the Rust Belt, but also in New England, the Mid-Atlantic, and are rarest in Nebraska and the Dakotas. Why is that? They're old-fashioned. They're hard-working people. They don't quit. Their cultures are like that. An inconsistent correlation between deaths of despair and economic hardship make it difficult to formulate policy-based solutions. Case and Deaton admitted last year that economic policies, even ones that successfully improve earnings and jobs to redistribute income, will take many years to reverse the increase in mortality. So that's the economic piece of this, right? All right, medical explanations run into similar problems. Plenty of drugs exist to make people feel better. Americans have been using them more frequently than ever. From 1999 to 2014, the proportion of Americans on antidepressants grew by 65%. And it wasn't a low number in 1999. And that's not even counting the use of opioids and painkillers. Similarly, more Americans than ever are in therapy. People diagnosed with a mental illness in America was up over 25%, were over 25% more likely to receive treatment in 2016 than 2003. But despite the increasing prevalence of mental health treatment, the rate of suicide is still growing. It's impossible to know how high the rate would be without the widespread use of antidepressants, painkillers, and therapy. but their ubiquity I'll define it. The fact of appearing everywhere or being very common. Okay, got it? Ubiquity. Suggests that despair runs deeper than the suicide rate can measure. When a social crisis resists easy economic or medical answers, it's tempting to declare the problem insoluble and demand that it be taken out of back alleys and into the sterile supervision of state-approved experts. San Francisco pursued this idea. Last fall, California State Assembly passed AB 186, a bill authorizing the city to set up safe injection sites where addicts could bring their own drugs to consume while state employees would provide any necessary paraphernalia and emergency first aid. I mean, honestly, this has gone on in Seattle, too. It aimed to provide addicts with a sterile environment and education on safe drug use. Similar proposals in Philadelphia, Seattle, several other states provoked a response from Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein. In a New York Times op-ed, Rosenstein declared that the federal government would prosecute any safe injection sites that open. Following Rosenstein's lead, California Governor Jerry Brown vetoed AB 186 when it reached his desk on September 20th. Fundamentally, Brown explained, I do not believe that enabling illegal drug use in government-sponsored injection centers will reduce drug addiction. Hello. Research into the deaths of despair won't shed much light if the underlying assumptions are faulty. That if the life expectancy declines aren't primarily economic or even medical, and the roots of American despair lie elsewhere. Some suggest that it's time to take a serious look at declining community and family life. Harvard's Tyler Vanderweil, for example, has found a link between church attendance and lower suicide rates, especially among women, while University of California Riverside sociologist Augustine Pessoa has noticed accumulating evidence that divorced and separated families have a much higher suicide rates than their married counterparts. For men, divorce correlates strongly to suicide. These results shouldn't be at all surprising. Church and family represents an organic social safety network. Without them, people can become isolated, lose a sense of purpose, and poorly equipped to cope with despair when it comes. It's easy to see how social isolation, especially if combined with losing a job or becoming reliant on an expensive medical treatment, can lead to a sense that one's life isn't going the way it should. And finally, the downside of focusing on family, church, and community from the perspective of an academic researcher or a federal agency is that there aren't easy solutions. There are no taxes, tariffs, therapies, or pills to keep people in pews and families intact. It's reasonable to expect that the near future will therefore bring more campaigns for safe injection sites, proposal to legalize the next miracle drug, and perhaps more latitude for euthanasia so to make suicide itself more safe. It's hard to believe any of these will increase Americans' life expectancies or stem the decline. But it's also possible that enough researchers will resist prevailing explanations, take seriously Redfield, Brown, and Rosenstein's call to investigate the real problem behind the decline of American life expectancy, and so begin the difficult task of reversing it. This appeared in the Weekly Standard. Written by Philip Luke Jeffrey. He's an editorial assistant at the Weekly Standard. He writes about baseball. Sorry, I just had to sneeze. But it's interesting. you know, the common things that you hear based on life experience in post-traumatic winning are purpose, giving, staying connected. Another word for family. What is all that? It's old-fashioned American values, honestly. Rejecting medication as much as you can. Now, I'm mindful that there are people that genuinely need it, and I don't want to be condescending or in any way, shape, or form demean that. But, again, low doses, short period of times to get you off that stuff and get you moving, you know, on with your life. You've existed for your your life without that stuff. But let me tell you, there's a powerful case that gets made to people that this is a chemical imbalance in your system, and we need to put you on this drug forever. I would be reluctant to do that. Those drugs are powerful, powerful drugs. And I go back to a conversation I had with somebody who was kind of feeling me out if I thought depression was a weakness or blah, blah, blah. What I didn't understand is you lived your whole life a certain way up until this point that you got to. Yes, that's true. And then what happened? Well, I was going through a divorce, and I lost my job, and I got overwhelmed, and I was having such issues, and I couldn't cope with it. And okay, so life rolled on you, yes. And that's when you got convinced that by a therapist that you needed to be on these drugs for the rest of your life. Yes. And then they will go and they will explain the chemical imbalance is just like any other medical condition, blah, blah. And I have a hard time with that, that explanation. Low doses, short period of time, learn coping skills, learn wellness practices, and get away from that stuff and get back on the path of your life. So again, the more I see this stuff, my natural inclination is that I'm wrong. That at some point somebody walks in the room and turns the light on and says, okay, McNamara, I'm going to unscrew you right now. But the more that I read, the more I talk to people, they keep coming back to, no, you're not wrong. No, you're not going to find that. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll do Today in History. More on a Monday. All Marine Radio continues after this.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
Hi, this is Tim McGarry from the McGarry Mortgage Minute. Heard every Wednesday right here on All Marine Radio, where I'll answer all your mortgage questions from home buying to home financing, from VA to conventional loans to moving in. So don't miss it. The McGarry Mortgage Minute, right here on All Marine Radio, on the All Warrior Radio Network. And remember, my name is McGarry, and I'm here to help.
Find all of Tim McGarry's contact information on the Read Board page at allmarineradio.com.
To be fully fit, you have to be physically fit. You also have to be mentally fit.
I wish that more warriors would realize how important it is if you get the psychological support that you need so that you can focus on the rest of your life.
I think it takes strength in order to admit that you have an issue, but it also takes intuitiveness of a friend, a leader, a supervisor to pick up on the signal that the soldier is having issues and needs to seek professional help in dealing with it.
It's also important for the lowest possible levels of leadership to be very supportive in helping their members get the help that they need.
When I went to get help, I had more help than I could ask for from my entire command. It's sometimes challenging to come to a senior staff member or senior officer in the unit with a problem. There's not a commanding officer out there or a leadership staff out there that doesn't want to help. So don't hesitate. Come ask.
Learn more by visiting www.realwarriors.net or calling 1-866-966-1020.
Hundreds of thousands of veterans have taken off their uniforms and put them away, carefully packed and safely stowed. But for some veterans, the uniform isn't so easily removed. The emotions experienced while serving continue to weigh on them. Life after service is different. Many veterans find transitioning difficult, and daily life is no longer as enjoyable as it once was. Some feel overwhelmed and lost. But that uncertainty doesn't take away from their strength and courage, nor does it take away from the sense of duty veterans carry with them. The transition from service is different for everyone. If you are a veteran going through a difficult time, or know one who is, the power of one person, one connection, one act of compassion can make a difference. For free 24/7 confidential support, call the Veterans Crisis Line at 1-800-273-8255 and press 1, or visit veteranscrisisline.net.
All you veterans, listen up. This is Bob Nielsen, former Marine and founder of the 100 Entrepreneurs Project. Turner Construction is looking for veterans with real-world leadership experience to join their team of professionals.
Hold on, Nielsen. Are we talking about a job or a career?
Matt, Turner Construction is a great company with global opportunities for veteran leaders who are looking to start professional careers. I know. I returned to Turner after I got back from Vietnam and retired after 50 years. I had a great career traveling the world leading teams of Turner employees as we built incredible projects.
Are they looking for me to have construction experience, Bob?
Absolutely not. Turner is looking for leaders who have led under pressure. We want leadership. So if you're led in Iraq or Afghanistan or any other contingency, Turner Construction is actively looking for you.
So, a career with competitive pay, good benefits, and a company seeking veteran leaders. That's what we're talking about.
Bingo. We're on the right road when a grunt can understand it. Good job, Mac.
I appreciate that there, Nielsen. How do I get the ball rolling? What do I do?
Just email your resume to jobs@allmarineradio.com. And I will personally contact you and we'll begin the process.
I love it. Turner Construction is looking for veteran leaders who are looking for careers to join their veteran-friendly team. Email Bob Nielsen at jobs@allmarineradio.com. Let's do it.
You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
Pop a top again. I've just got time for one more round. Set 'em up, my friend. Then I'll be gone and you can let some other fool sit down. I'd like for you to listen to a joke I heard today. From a woman who said she was through and calmly walked away. I tried to smile and did a while, but it felt so out of place.
Time for us to do Today in History.
Ever hear of a clown with teardrops streaming?
I need to do the Today in History bumper music. Hold on.
Pop a top again.
Right. Here you go.
Then I'll be gone.
Today in History, brought to you by All Marine Radio. Hold on, let's hear it again. That's how important this music is. And maybe I'll shut it off this time. On this date in 2014, Sony Pictures cancels the release of the upcoming 2014 film, The Interview, originally scheduled for the next day due to threatening messages by hackers connected with North Korea.
Oh.
Remember that? Yeah. On this date in 2013, Edward Snowden offered Brazil information over the NSA spying on its citizens. On this date in 2012, Daniel Inouye, Medal of Honor recipient, he was a senior senator from Hawaii, died in Honolulu at the age of 88. On this date in 2004, President Bush signed the largest overhaul of U.S. intelligence gathering, the largest overhaul of U.S. intelligence gathering in 50 years. On this date in 2001, the last cave complex at Tora Bora had been taken and its defenders overrun. U.S. and U.K. forces continued searching into January, but no sign of al-Qaeda leadership emerged. An estimated 200 al-Qaeda fighters were killed during the battle, along with an unknown number of tribal fighters. No American or British deaths were reported. Tora Bora. The slow movement into Tora Bora instead of jumping the 82nd or 101st Airborne in there allowed Osama bin Laden to escape. He would be caught in, 2011? 2010? One of them. I don't know. I was in Afghanistan. I know that. So it's one of those 2 years. In 2001, U.S. Marines raised the Stars and Stripes over the long-abandoned American embassy in Kabul, inaugurating what U.S. Envoy James Dobbins promised would be a long commitment to the rebuilding. On this date in 1991, pretty significant date, man, December 17th, after a long meeting between Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev and President of the Russian Federation, Boris Yeltsin, a spokesman for the latter announced that the Soviet Union will officially cease to exist on or before New Year's Day. Yeltsin declared that there will be no more red flag. It was a rather anticlimactic culmination of events leading towards the dismantling of the Soviet Union. Despite the dramatic implications, the announcement inspired mostly yawns and skeptical jokes from a Russian population weary from months of political intrigue and instability and a crumbling economy. For many people, the Soviet Union had already disintegrated. The various Russian republics had already declared their independence. In a few days, they would meet and form the Commonwealth of Independent States. Pretty amazing. I mean, we talked about that last week, or 2 weeks ago, during the funeral of President Bush. How American restraint and him not going over there and thumping his chest was a bit of a component in the demise of the Soviet Union. And how that was not made into something that made that task more difficult. For those of you that are old enough to remember, Red Brigade terrorists kidnapped Brigadier General James Dozier, the highest ranking U.S. NATO officer in Italy. Now, if you remember the story about Dozier's rescue, it was his first name. James. Now, I just want to, there's a, the version that I've heard. This is from the New York Times. Let's see. It's out of their archives. The story that was popular at the time was the CIA could not find this guy and contacted the mafia, and within 24 hours the mafia told him where it was. Now, I don't know if that's entirely true. Okay, maybe I should do a Scopes thing on that. Scopes, whatever it is. And see if that's true. Mafia's help reported in rescue of Dozier, according to the New York Times. American and Italian intelligence official turned to the mafia for help in locating Brigadier General. Jeez. Now, that's the New York Times. Later on, Italy denies mafia helped rescue Dozier. Funny. Anyway, so it goes. On this date, 1944, during the Battle of the Bulge, the Malmedy Massacre would occur, in which 84 Americans from the 285th Field Artillery Observation Battalion, who had become prisoners of war, were shot by the Waffen SS under Joachim Piper. I think Piper is later executed for that. Let me just... J-O-C-H... I-M-P-I-E-P-E-R, German, SS, General, Joachim Piper, Wikipedia, how did he die? Piper was convicted of war crimes committed in Belgium and imprisoned for almost 12 years. He was accused of war crimes in Italy, but Italian and German courts concluded that there was insufficient evidence to warrant prosecution. After his release from prison, Piper worked for both Porsche and Volkswagen before moving to France, where he translated books from English to German under the nom de plume Rainer Boschmann. Piper was murdered in France in July of 1976. Let's read about his murder. And then, under war crimes, Malmedy, other murders, interrogation, trial. Come on, let's get down to his return to civilian life years later and death. Residing in France since 1972, Piper led a quiet and discreet life. However, he continued to use his given name. Probably a mistake. In 1974, he was identified by a former communist resistance member of the region who issued a report to the French Communist Party. In 1976, a communist historian investigating the Gestapo archives found the Piper file. On 21 June, tracks denouncing his presence were distributed in traves. I don't know what that means, tracks. T-R-A-C-T-S, denouncing his presence were distributed in Treves, which I believe was where he lived in France. A day later, an article in the radical left-wing publication Les Humanités revealed Piper's presence in Traves, and he received threats that his house would be burned down and his dogs killed. On receipt of these threats, Piper, who remained in Traves, sent his family back to Germany during the night of 13-14 July 1976, Bastille Day. Piper's home was attacked. In the ruin, Piper's charred corpse was found together with a .22 caliber rifle and a pistol. The perpetrators were never identified. The investigators found that intruders had cut a wire fence between the house and neighboring properties. All three of Piper's dogs had been wounded. Traces of shot and spent shell casings consistent with the rifle, shotgun, and revolver Piper had to protect himself were found outside, suggesting he had fired at the intruders from outside the house. But if they had guns of their own, they may not have fired them at all, since no bullets or shots were found at places Piper had fired from. Instead, the attackers had thrown firebombs, including at least one Molotov cocktail, at the house to start the fire, which arson specialists found had been set at three locations at once. But outside the house, they found some clothing belonging to Piper's wife, as well as some personal papers, including his last letter to her and a binocular. Piper's body was burnt down to a mere 24 inches, was found in the remains of his study where those papers would have been kept. Based on evidence, investigators with the Dijon police judiciary concluded that Piper had heard the intruders enter his property, left the house to fire at them. When that did not prevent the firebombing, he returned to the house in an attempt to save his and his wife's valuables by throwing them out the study window, continuing to fire at the attackers outside while the body was too badly burned to determine the exact cause of death. The official conclusion that he died of smoke inhalation in the attempt and not at the hands of his attacker. A group calling itself the Avengers claimed responsibility for his death. The charred remains of his house. How does he not get convicted of the Malmedy massacre? Trial. The trial took place in Dachau from 16 May to 16 July 1946 before a military tribunal of senior American officers operating under the rules established by the Nuremberg International Military Tribunal. Together with 42 other defendants, Joachim Piper was sentenced to death by hanging on 16 July 1946. The sentences generated significant controversy in some German circles, including the church, leading the commander of the U.S. Army in Germany to commute some of the death sentences to life imprisonment. In addition, German defense attorneys, U.S. military attorney Lieutenant Colonel Willis Everett, appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court, claiming the defendants had been found guilty of means by illegal and fraudulently procured confessions and were subjects of a mock trial. The turmoil raised by this case caused the Secretary of the Army, Kenneth Royall, to create a commission chaired by Judge Gordon A. Simpson of Texas to investigate. The commission was interested in the Malmedy massacre trial and in other cases charged at Dachau. The commission arrived in Europe in July of 1948, issued its report in September. Can you imagine? There'd be 3 years of investigating if it were done today. The commission confirmed the accuracy of Everett's conclusions regarding mock trials and neither disputed nor denied the charges of torture of the defendants. The commission expressed the opinion that the pretrial investigation had not been properly conducted and the members felt that no death sentence should be executed where such doubt existed. In response, General Lucius Clay commuted six more death sentences 2 life imprisonment, but refused to commute 6 remaining death sentences, including Piper's, though the executions were postponed. The turmoil caused the commission report. The turmoil caused by the commission report caused the U.S. Senate to investigate the trial. Investigations opened in 1950, including several Senate committees, of which Joseph McCarthy was prepared to launch his sensationalist career. In its investigation of the trial, the Senate Armed Service Committee came to the conclusion of improper pretrial procedures, including a mock trial, but not torture as sometimes stated, had indeed affected the trial process. There was little or no doubt that some of the accused were indeed guilty of the massacre. Ultimately, the sentence of the Malmedy defendants were commuted to life imprisonment and then to time served. Piper's sentence was commuted to 35 years in 1954 and was released 2 years later. The last of the Malmedy condemned to be freed. He'd served 11 and a half years in prison. HAIG, an organization of former Waffen-SS members, had already helped Piper's wife find a job near the Landsberg prison. They then worked to achieve the conditional release of Piper himself. To obtain his release from prison, Piper had to prove that he could obtain the job. Through the intermediary Albert Prinzing, a former SS Hauptsturmfuhrer, whatever the hell that is, he got a job as a car manufacturer for Porsche. Pretty amazing, though, isn't it? On this date in history, Malmedy. And the people that were in charge of it, they skated. All right. That does it for today. Tomorrow, Grant Mnuchin might rejoin us. He's written a story that kind of surprised me. And I wrote him to explain. The Japanese are converting a helicopter carrier into an aircraft carrier. And I say good on them. Good on them. But Grant said no. No, that it's not a good thing. I was like, what? So I might drag him on to explain that before the Christmas break. The term is lawnmower parents. It's from Lou. Lou Yu. Lou's a great listener, by the way. The term describes parents who are worse than helicopter parents. The term to describe parents that are worse than helicopter parents is lawnmower parents. Them mow over and through all obstacles that their children face. Yeah. And our whole society, I mean, look, it's interesting because what we're talking about in the Marine Corps, what I talk about in Hour 2, is that. It's we don't want any consequences. And so the Marine Corps has made things like that used to be staples of life, EMI. The Marine Corps has made that impossible to execute. You know? And so simply when somebody steps over a line, to hold them accountable, tough. To the point that I would tell you the inmates think they have a say in running the asylum. They don't run it. They think they have a say in it. So, anyway, I'm not sure how it exists. So it's interesting. You know, the tweet that started this discussion was a retweet of a John Haidt tweet. Every society has realized that children and adults, too, need adversity to grow. We can't reach maturity without adversity. It's a great quote. That takes us to the depths of despair, an article written by Philip Luke Jeffrey in the National Standard. And it talks about CDC documented increase in drug overdoses, increase in suicide, and the lowering of American life expectancy. Where do we lay that to? No consequences, families that can't stay together and be mutually supporting, and people that lose their way, become isolated, and then in their isolation they take their lives. All right. Have a great day. Merry Christmas to everybody. Happy holiday to everybody else. And if you don't celebrate anything, what's up? Yeah, we had a birthday party last night here. And I didn't even know, like, during the week, Catherine, my daughter, says, we're gonna cook dinner. I said, what? Yeah, me and Patrick are going to cook dinner. I said, okay. But I didn't associate it with anything, so I worked out late in the day. And when I came home, there was all these birthday things up. And I was like, oh, you're cooking dinner for my birthday? We're having a birthday party? Nice. So we had a birthday party. Yeah. A surprise birthday party. I thought it was just dinner, but it was a birthday party. So, had a good time last night. Had a good time last night. My 49ers won, even though I can't watch the NFL. They're still my team. With all that said, have a great afternoon. We'll see you tomorrow. All Marine Radio. Over and out.